Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Since March of 2020, healthcare workers have been on the front line of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their tireless, often heroic efforts were initially lauded by ordinary citizens who witnessed our healthcare system being deluged with patients and who watched as the number of people dying from the virus mounted relentlessly. Today, more people have died from COVID than did during the 1918 flu epidemic. For a moment, exhausted healthcare workers saw a light at the end of the tunnel. Three highly effective vaccines were made available, because so many individuals refused to get those vaccines, refused even to wear a mask in some cases, hospital ICUs are filling once again. In fact, patient levels in some places in the country have eclipsed what hospitals experienced in the pre-vaccine era. The result is burnout of healthcare workers who have been engaged not only in trying to save the lives of a tsunami of COVID-stricken people for 18 months, they continue to have to cope with an enormous loss of life. This is taxing hospitals, delaying care for people who have other medical issues, and resulting in many healthcare workers reevaluating their career choices. 60% of healthcare workers say stress from the pandemic has harmed their mental health. Some have taken early retirement just when their numbers are needed most. I can describe this tragedy, but to get a fuller understanding, we need to hear from those who are living and working through it. And this hour we will. Jason Cook is Director of Critical Care and Neurosciences at Novant Health Presbyterian Medical Center in Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Cynthia Patel is a hospitalist providing patient care at Caremont Regional Medical Center in Gastonia. She is also assistant director of the hospitalist group there. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Lorene Temming is a maternal fetal medicine specialist and medical director at Atrium Health Labor and Delivery. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Candace Bashaw is here. She is an oncology nurse navigator at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me on.
Good morning to you all. The Delta variant of the COVID-19 virus is driving, as I said, hospitalizations nationwide, mostly among those who are unvaccinated. How would you compare conditions at your respective institutions today, this morning, right now, to what they were a year ago? And I'll begin with the only guy on the program, and then we'll hear from all the women. Jason, how would you compare it?
Honestly, I would say it's probably significantly worse. We've come up with a lot of challenges, and it's shifted the paradigm significantly from last year to this year. And going through the ebbs and flows of having the different surges that we've had to go through has really put quite a tremendous strain on the teams, the medical staff, the hospitalists, the nurses. It's not to go without saying, it's also with our support teams too. So our EVS teams, environmental services, the transporters, everybody, it's a team effort, and it really has put a tremendous strain on everyone. And, you know, with social events that have happened over the last year and a half as well, it's definitely gotten much worse.
So Jason speaks for what's going on at Novant. Lorene Temming, Dr. Temming, how are things at Atrium?
Yeah, I would echo the same thing. I think that they're unfortunately as bad as they've ever been in terms of, all of our ICU beds being filled and at maximum capacity there. Where I work on labor and delivery, we're just as busy as ever because, people keep having babies, which is great, but we're seeing more and more pregnant women who are ill with this Delta variant. And then I would agree, I think it's just been a challenging couple of years in healthcare, and that has affected everyone who works in the industry. And I think, we're seeing that from staffing difficulties to people's overall kind of wellness at work. So it's been a bit of a hard time for sure.
The other major hospital system in this region, of course, is Caremont. Dr. Patel, how are things in Gastonia?
Sure, Mike. I agree with our colleagues at Novant and CMC. We're definitely feeling the burden at Caremont as well. Community vaccination rates definitely play a role in our area. ICU beds are full. This Delta variant has definitely put a strain on our healthcare system as far as filling up, making beds and nursing staffage. You know, it's definitely been burdensome on everyone.
I'm going to take a leap of faith here, Candace Bashaw. You're a nurse navigator at Levine Cancer Center at Atrium. I would assume that means you help patients navigate the Byzantine situation that is healthcare in cancer care at the hospital. What impact has this had on patients who are not coming to you for COVID treatment? They're coming to you for cancer treatment. How has it impacted what you're able to do for them and how you work with them?
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, cancer care and a cancer diagnosis in and of itself is already very difficult. You add the strain of COVID on top of that, and it just seems almost impossible for some of these patients. We do see them more in an outpatient setting, but a lot of these patients we have to send into the hospital for various issues, and we know ER wait times are overwhelmed. It's almost impossible to get beds for these patients. So we are seeing a tremendous strain on our healthcare system as well.
Jason, you wrote an opinion piece that appeared this week in the Charlotte Observer, which you titled "A Plea from the ICU," and you insisted what so many others have said in the past, that COVID is real, as though that needs to be said, but evidently it does. You write that some people deny, quote, even with a spouse, child, or parent on life support, that COVID is real. They're denying that in the face of what they're witnessing in the hospital bed. Why is that mistakenly held idea so difficult to correct? Why is it holding so strong?
Yeah, that's hard to put a finger on it. You know, I think there's a lot of grief that goes into it. There's a lot of denial. You know, the situations get pretty extreme in the ICU. And, you know, we have residual with ICU. So when we say that we have a certain quantity or number of patients that are COVID positive, we look at infectious rates, and unfortunately, it's done its toll. And even though you're not, you know, quote unquote positive, they're still on ventilators after the, you know, the days that they've been 20 plus days on a ventilator, even longer when we have to put trachs in for the patients, so they still are not able to breathe on their own. And it's just being able to grasp the, you know, the severity of the illness in itself. And it's really, really tragic. And I really don't quite understand it, but we have had several people that still deny to say that COVID is a thing and it is real.
This program is going to be focused on healthcare workers and the impact of this on healthcare workers, but it's difficult to talk about that without bringing in what we just talked about, the impact on patients and their families. Dr. Patel, this region never experienced the kind of flood of patients that New York City had to face at the very beginning of this pandemic, nor do I believe are we facing the flood of patients that hospitals in states like Mississippi or Alabama or even Florida are experiencing right now. But we have experienced, you just said that the ICU beds are full. And people, they're full, and there's turnover in those beds. Some people leave because they recover. Some people leave because they don't. But they keep filling up the beds. What is the impact of that on the people who care for those folks, the doctors, the nurses, et cetera?
Very burdensome. It's very emotional. I think patients and family members have to understand that we are humans as well. We have emotions. We have a personal attachment with our patients. It impacts us mentally, physically, and emotionally. These are, you know, real life situations that when you go home back to your families, it's hard to turn that switch off. You know, you think about it, it affects you personally, especially with me having young children. You know, sometimes we lose patients of all ages, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents, and it weighs heavily on us as healthcare workers too. There's many days where our nurses cry, or our doctors cry. You know, we have an emotional attachment, and it's hard.
It would be bad enough if this were just an epidemic that was a medical problem, but this has become a political problem, which is partly to blame for why the epidemic has gotten out of control in this and other countries. Jason, and maybe others want to chime in on this too, but since you're on the front lines of this as a general care person, which is the more serious problem here? The relentless turnover of people coming into your ICUs, the intense care that many of these patients must receive, the mounting number of deaths of people of all ages, or the fact that now that there is a preventive vaccine that can keep you out of the hospital and usually keep you from succumbing to COVID-19, but people won't take it. Which of those factors comes to bear the most heavily on care workers?
I would say all of the above, Mike. you know, in all honesty, they all play a factor into it. Unfortunately, it's multifactorial. And, you know, to speak on the side of not being able to take the vaccine, you know, certainly we respect people's, you know, rights and opinions. You know, there's many, many people that don't believe in other vaccinations as well. However, you know, that does play a huge part in the ability to control this virus. And, you know, looking at it from the perspective of it continuing and having the ebbs and flows, it's going to continue to cause burnout. You know, we're at a place in the medical community where it's very difficult to continue down this road and have our nurses and our doctors and our respiratory therapists day in and day out having to deal with this. And, you know, I've been at this for roughly 20 years in the healthcare community in some form or fashion. I've seen more death in the past two years than I have my entire career. You know, Novant and the entirety has had roughly about 550,000 vaccines administered in the community, which is great, but we still got a lot of work to do to kind of control this. And it's, you know, COVID's not going away. It's going to be here in some form or fashion, probably for the entirety of our given lives. But, you know, as I wrote in part of the editorial piece that I had, you know, when September 11th happened, we were able to band together as a community. And I really hope that we can do this as a community today.
Dr. Temming, you're a maternal fetal medical specialist, and Candace Bashaw, you are an oncology nurse, and we're going to talk about the impact of COVID on your two specialties. But before we do that, just a general question, because you're healthcare workers, and you're seeing what's happening in the hospital, and then you go out into the world, you go to the grocery store, and prior to the mask mandate, you saw people in there treating this as though it were any other day in the rest of their lives, with no tip of the hat even to the fact that we're in the middle of this pandemic. And you know the impact of this pandemic. What impact did that have on you personally, Dr. Temming?
Yeah, I would say that's been one of the hardest parts. You know, when you're listing all those choices, I felt like taking one of those multiple choice tests where you just want to check all the answers. But I think one of the things that's been hardest right now, since, you know, late July, early August, when this Delta variant really started impacting us, is exactly what you said. I go into the hospital to round. I'm rounding on three or four pregnant women in the ICU, which, you know, anybody who, Dr. Patel, anybody who works in an ICU can tell you that it's not usual to have pregnant women in an ICU. It's not not expected and not fun. So I see three or four pregnant women in my ICU, and I'm, you know, talking to their families, talking to the people who love them on rounds. And then I leave work and I'm driving home and pass, you know, everyone having brunch or at restaurants or what have you. And it just feels very incongruous.
And let me stop you there. I'll get your response to that, Candace, in a moment. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of COVID on our hospital and healthcare workers with Jason Cook, a director of critical care and neuroscience at Novant, Dr. Siddhi Patel, hospitalist at Caremont Regional Medical Center in Gastonia, Dr. Lorene Temming, maternal-fetal medical specialist and medical director at Atrium Health Labor and Delivery, and Candace Bashaw, oncology nurse at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. And I just asked Dr. Temming, Candace, about her reaction to knowing what she knows about what's happening in the hospitals and then going out into the world at large and seeing people act as though this was just any day in 2019 or 2001 with no pandemic raging, what her reaction to that is. And I'm curious about yours, because you deal with cancer patients who are immunosuppressed and you know what they face if they catch this virus. And you go out to the grocery store and people are just casual about it, or a restaurant or a shopping center.
Yeah, it's tough to go out into public and see people that aren't doing the right thing, masking, socially distancing. It's hard to come back knowing that we are taking care of patients that are immunosuppressed, and knowing the implications for them if they get COVID. You know, it could be much more severe for them to get COVID than it would be for the general population. So it's hard to go out and see that and not be able to really say anything or address that with them, because, you know, people are just so political about it sometimes. So,
Dr. Patel, this has been going on for 18 months or more now in some parts of the country. And initially, doctors were at risk because they couldn't get enough PPE to protect themselves from a virus. They didn't know exactly a lot about the virus. They learned as they went. And some doctors and nurses lost their lives dealing with these patients, through no fault of their own. Fast forward to today, it continues. We have these three vaccines that are highly effective, and yet some people won't get them. And 95% of the patients, I think, in hospitals today for COVID are there because they were unvaccinated. A Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll reveals that 6 in 10, 60% of healthcare workers believe their mental health has been impacted by this constant onslaught of patients and death. Do you think those numbers are accurate?
Yeah, Mike, I would have to agree. We have effective vaccines that are now out there. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of lack of education. Every opportunity that I get with my patients, you know, I encourage vaccination. There is a night and day difference between the patients that are coming in and ending up on the ventilators versus those that are vaccinated. What we tend to see in the vaccinated folks is they may have some breakthrough COVID cases, but it's mild upper respiratory symptoms, such as a sniffle here or there, or sneezing here or there, and they recover at home. The ones that are coming in, the statistics are accurate. They are unvaccinated. And with this Delta variant, it's affecting our younger age population, 20s, 30s. There has been a trend with this variant where we're seeing younger folks, and some with comorbidities and some without comorbidities. Obesity, hypertension, diabetes, all these risk factors definitely play a role into the prognosis in these patients. We are also speaking on cancer patients. These cancer patients comply, they get vaccinated, but because they're immunocompromised, they don't mount a response like the general population would. Therefore, they're at higher risk. And we are seeing breakthrough cases where these patients come in, and it's difficult that the community doesn't respect, you know, what's going out in the public.
There is an article in this morning's New York Times about Australia and how they've been handling this. And in their country has taken two different approaches. The eastern part of the country is open, and I think either the eastern or western part of Australia is open as though it were normal, and the other side is locked down. And they're comparing the difference in how it works. But one thing that has emerged among both sides of Australia is that their approach is more focused on community benefits, the common good, than that in the United States. And one of the things that you're pointing out through what you just said, Dr. Patel, is that one good reason to wear a mask or to get vaccinated is because you're protecting those who cannot get the vaccine, or who are immunocompromised and for whom the vaccine may not be quite as effective as it would be in a completely healthy person. And we kind of brush that off to the side, or some people do. Jason, you work in critical care. You are also you also work in respiratory care. And in your Observer piece, you write about how this disease, quote, ravages the body. Some people think this is just the sniffles or a bad cough, or you can't breathe and so you have to be intubated, but that'll come out and you'll be okay at the end. There are long-term effects to this disease that we're still discovering. What does it do?
You know, what doesn't it do is kind of, I would say, is probably more the answer. The people that end up in ICU unfortunately have multi-system organ failure, and they end up on dialysis or something that we call CRRT, which is continuous renal replacement therapy, which is the predecessor to having to have hemodialysis. Certainly it affects the lungs. Obviously, that's something that we all know, but I think they equate COVID with COVID pneumonia. We see a lot of necrotic pneumonias with this too, so that essentially with the alveoli in the lungs, that they don't inflate anymore. They're unable to, use their lungs by themselves. Patients have to end up with tracheostomies, which can be long-term. They have to go to facilities and skilled rehabs where they might end up on a ventilator, a home ventilator, for long term. And long haulers is real. It's they do have long lasting effects, and in addition to that, there's several clotting factors. And I in my experience, being that I'm over several of the ICUs, neuro ICU, cardiac ICU, we've actually seen significant uptick in strokes. There's two types of strokes. You have your hemorrhagic and your ischemic stroke. So when you have a brain bleed, that's a hemorrhagic stroke. So we're seeing that when people are ventilated and they wake up, they've had strokes during COVID, that you since you're on, on paralytics and you're also sedated, you're not always able to recognize, because when somebody has a stroke, if me and you were talking today, you can recognize signs and symptoms. It's across the board. It's your brain, it's your lungs, it's your heart, it's your kidneys, every last bit.
Dr. Temming.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that it's important to highlight that there are these sequelae of COVID for people who don't end up in the ICU, for people who aren't super sick. Long COVID is definitely real. So I myself had severe COVID, which, I got likely from work and in the winter before the vaccine was available. And I have very real long COVID symptoms. And we're seeing that among all kinds of patients. For me now, patients who are getting pregnant who still have symptoms from the COVID that they had several months ago. So I think, people hear about people sick in the ICU and it's easy to think, oh, that won't happen to me, I'm young and healthy. But there are these very real consequences, even for people who are never so sick as to need ICU care.
In some parts of the country, hospitals have been delaying care for patients who have illnesses other than COVID because their hospital beds are all taken up and their staff is exhausted by this. But you can't stop a child from being born. That's going to happen whether COVID's present or not. But I'm curious, Candace, with regard to cancer patients, these folks, as we say, if they're on chemotherapy or some other kind of therapy, they may be immunocompromised. Has your hospital put off treatment for some of these patients? Are some of these patients afraid to come in for treatment and delay their own treatment because they don't want to be around people who may have COVID?
I think from a chemotherapy standpoint, patients are coming in and getting treatment. One of the biggest impacts that we've seen are patients are delaying screenings, so colonoscopies, mammograms, things like that, because either they're afraid to come in or we haven't been able to get them scheduled for these procedures because the hospital systems are so overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. We've also had to delay some surgeries, mastectomies, and things like that because we just don't have beds available for these patients after they've had a surgical procedure done.
And what does that mean for those patients who have to wait for surgery?
That could potentially impact the outcome of their surgery and the stage of their cancer and what treatments that they need afterwards. For some of these patients, the mastectomy or some other type of surgery may be all that they need, but if we wait longer, that could potentially change things for them. They may require chemotherapy and radiation afterwards.
And Dr. Temming, I read yesterday that pregnant women face significant threats from COVID. You say that a pregnant woman who gets COVID-19 has a greater chance of getting very sick and of being hospitalized. They are also more likely to experience complications. I'd never heard of that. Do you think most people were aware of that?
I think probably not. I think we think of pregnancy as a very happy and healthy time in a person's life and in the life of a family, but really pregnancy is an immunocompromised state. And so pregnant women are at increased risk for severe disease and end up on, you know, ventilators, on heart lung bypass machines and all of those sorts of things, and are at higher risk for that than the general population.
How big a problem in your, I know this is anecdotal because you only deal with one universe of patients, but how big a problem has this been for the patients that you see and are aware of?
I mean, I think it's been a huge problem. As I said, seeing way more patients hospitalized during their pregnancy, in the ICU during their pregnancy, unfortunately, even losing their babies. And across the Southeast, you know, we're seeing increased rates of maternal death, which is, you know, something we hope and pray to never see. And we are seeing that as a result of COVID. And we really, you know, I just can't say enough how important it is for pregnant women to be vaccinated. I think when you're pregnant, it's hard to decide what to do, what to take, who to listen to. But, you know, the CDC, the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, we all want pregnant women to be vaccinated.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that continues to be in the news, and there continues to be myths and misinformation surrounding that. Some people don't get vaccinated. Some pregnant women don't get vaccinated because they fear unintended consequences of getting that shot. Is there any reason that a pregnant woman should not get the vaccine?
Certainly not a reason that I can think of. I think this misinformation around this issue has been really tough. I think it's also hard. You know, I'm a mom, and I know from before you're pregnant, you worry about every little thing that you might do that could have a negative impact on your child. And that continues, of course, after birth as well. And, you know, it's taken some time to accumulate substantial data, but we do have that substantial data now. More than 150,000 pregnant women have been vaccinated. We know that the vaccine and the vaccine product do not cross the placenta, do not get to the babies. The only thing that getting vaccinated while you're pregnant does is really help protect you from getting sick and your baby, because proteins cross the placenta.
It's interesting that you say that it doesn't cross the placenta and does not impact the babies, because yesterday evening CBS News reported that pregnant women who get vaccinated pass that protection on to their babies. That's not true?
No, I was just saying that the only thing that gets to the babies is these protective proteins that can fight against COVID. So
they do pass the protection on.
That none of the vaccine product gets across the placenta, but the antibodies that your body makes to fight against COVID do cross the placenta and get to babies. And then the babies have these antibodies, which can help them fight COVID.
And let's bust one more myth that needs to be taken care of. Some women don't get it because they're afraid that the vaccine will make them less fertile. No truth to that.
That's absolutely a myth, and that has been spread on social media. And I know it's very scary, but there is no truth to that. So part of the myth goes that there's some similarity between a placenta protein and the spike protein that the vaccine fights against, and that's just not true. And there's been numerous studies that have shown no impact on people's fertility of getting vaccinated.
So you're fighting all of that as you're trying to save lives and as you're trying to do your job, whether it's the birthing babies or helping cancer patients go through their treatment successfully or whatever people are coming to you for. But let's turn our attention back to healthcare workers and the impact of all of this on them. We have all these reports now around the country of burnout, of mental and physical exhaustion, of morale problems, of depression. Professionals leaving the field, or choosing a different line of work, or simply retiring because they've had enough. How much of a problem is that in this region? I'm going to hear from Jason first and then Dr. Patel.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's pretty significant. There's always been a nursing shortage. It's even more evident now. There's a lot of, you know, nursing creates a a pathway for a lot of different areas for you to work in. And it being that you, it's pretty daunting to come into work day after day and having to deal with this, it just creates a further divide, and it's significant, and it's getting worse. I am fearful for the future. We're having to look at things from a different perspective. What does the future of nursing and healthcare look like? How are we going to deliver care? We are in the age of a digital approach. Is that the take that we're going to do? But we're having to look at things. We're able to manage, however, hospitals are extremely busy. The staffing shortages are real, and they continue to get worse.
Dr. Patel.
I agree with Jason. I think this problem is a global problem, not only here in America, but worldwide. I mean, all countries are facing this pandemic at different times. Definitely seeing the shortage, we're having to outsource staffing as far as pulling in travel nurses or nurses from the outpatient setting to come into the hospital and help. Physician shortages. I mean, I commend our group internally, especially our hospitals group, but we have doctors stepping up. I mean, we've taken an oath to help our patients, and we continue with that in mind. And day after day, we put our shoes on and our coats on, and we handle business.
But it is causing problems, health problems, real problems for healthcare workers and also for the system, because healthcare workers are hanging it up and going elsewhere. I just anecdotally, you're all working in clinical settings. What have you witnessed? What conversations have you had with your fellow workers who seem to be impacted by this, perhaps some more than others? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
Mike, I could say that, to speak to Dr. Patel, we have had several people that have gone off to different horizons. You've got people that have real PTSD. We have excellent programs with our employee assistance programs that, have our therapists and that kind of thing that can come help. But I mean, people have had to seek, treatment when it comes to that, which might not have had to previously. I think healthcare workers in general have to put on different hats than when they walk in one patient's room and then they walk in the next patient's room, which may be death and dying, but the further one might be being discharged. And, the outlook is a little bit more grim. You're having people that are choosing options that are not necessarily healthcare related. So it's been tough.
I want to come back to something you just said, PTSD. You don't normally associate that with people in a clinical setting. That those are people affected by PTSD have had trauma in their own lives and military situations and more. But why now in medical settings? We'll come back and talk about that. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the burnout among healthcare workers facing a never-ending onslaught of patients because of COVID-19. Jason Cook is Director of Critical Care and Neuroscience at Novant Presbyterian Hospital here in Charlotte. Dr. Lorene Temming is a maternal fetal medical specialist and medical director of the Atrium Health Labor and Delivery Department. Dr. Siddhi Patel is a hospitalist at Caramont Regional Medical Center, and Candace Bashaw is an oncology nurse at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. Jason just brought up PTSD among healthcare workers. And as I said, you normally hear about PTSD from people who have suffered severe trauma in their personal lives, like being raped or attacked on the streets, or people in the military who have been part of a terrible situation in combat. You don't hear about it much in the context of medical personnel. Explain it, Dr. Patel, in that context.
It definitely affects healthcare workers on a mental level. Speaking for myself and maybe some of my colleagues, right now, day in, day out, we're still living in this COVID era that a lot of us have not really had the time to sit back and reflect on things. But once COVID starts dissipating a little bit and we get back to our norms, I think that's when the PTSD and the anxiety or the emotions will really start, venging up. Right now, it's just day in, day out, it's COVID, COVID, COVID. And we really have not stepped back from the COVID front to really reflect on things. But another year or so, I think we'll see definitely a rise in healthcare workers battling depression, battling anxiety, really grieving. You know, right now it's you grieve, but then you move on. And then it's we just don't see an end in sight yet is where I'm getting to. But another year or so, I'm hoping that the COVID starts turning around to where at some point achieve herd immunity and we would have the time to sit back and really reflect on the last several years and what we've encountered.
And just as flight attendants are experiencing hostility from their passengers, but they're protected by the FAA, who has seriously cracked down on passengers who disobey. You don't have that protection. And I'm told the New York Times reports that there is sometimes open hostility from patients who have spent months steeped in right-wing commentary and conspiracy theories that have turned healthcare workers into adversaries. Are you aware of that happening in your clinical settings? Dr. Temming.
Yeah, you know, I would say it's hard. I've certainly run into that. Part of that, I think, is, you know, as we've been saying, that it's become so political, but it can happen when you ask patients to wear masks, which is required in our setting. Somehow masks have become a weapon in political discussions. And then, you know, I think all of us, I particularly am making an effort to talk to all of my patients about getting vaccinated. And it's sort of surprising that that is such a touchy issue for people, but sometimes it does open up some hostility. So that's been really hard.
Some people say they don't know what's in the vaccine. Other people claim that all kinds of things that are incorrect are in the vaccine, like detergents and other things they claim are in the vaccine because they've read it off some wacko website that they shouldn't be reading in the first place. But they do, and that's what they believe. But yet they'll come into a hospital setting, and they'll take these monoclonal antibodies, which I'm sure cost a lot more than the vaccine, and they don't know what's in those either. How do you explain that behavior? We don't know what's in any of the meds. We don't know what's in an Advil when you come right down to it. How do you explain the suspicion over this vaccine versus anything else that a doctor may prescribe in a hospital setting or just over-the-counter medication? Dr. Patel.
Yeah, this is something that we deal with on a daily basis. We have patients that are anti-vaccine and unfortunately come down with COVID, come to the hospital seeking help. Our doors are open 24/7. We treat our vaccinated versus unvaccinated patients equally. And now here they are on the verge of ventilation, asking for every medication that's available. And I educate my patients that every medication that we have on the market is all emergency use authorized. There is nothing FDA proven that I'm about to give you. What we are giving is what we've seen data in clinical trials and say, here, this is what we have to offer. I'm hopeful it will work, but there is no guarantee. What is out there that's effective, known to work, in clinical trials is the vaccine, and it is FDA approved. Everything else that we have, Regeneron, the monoclonal antibodies, the Actemra, these are all under EUA.
And Jason, that leads me to Novant, because your hospital just suspended 375 employees for not getting the vaccine. Some of them, I'm sure, were doctors and nurses. Others were just personnel that work at the hospital. But they work in a hospital, and it's very difficult for lay people to trust the vaccine if there are people in hospitals, doctors and nurses among them, who are unwilling to get the vaccine. What message is that sending to average people out there who are vaccine hesitant?
I mean, it is a difficult message, and, you know, we do urge people to get the vaccine, you know, across the board. And that's across 15 different hospital systems, our, you know, over 800 different clinics. And it's a combination of not only healthcare professionals, but it's also support services as well. People do have, religious and medical exemptions, and that goes for the flu vaccine as well. So that's inclusive of those individuals that may or may not have had an exemption that was evaluated by a team of people. But it certainly, I think, falls into the same factor of, kind of the political fire of what's been going on with the rest of the country as well in the world. So I think we're people too, right? So I think it definitely falls into the same kind of category where people are, feeling the same way as their neighbor might work in finance.
Candace, I think you mentioned that you've had to have conversations about getting the vaccine among your cancer patients. And I'm wondering, even if you haven't had those conversations, I'm sure you're aware of other clinicians having to have conversations about this. If you are talking to somebody with a firmly held belief that these are harmful things that they don't want in their bodies, has anybody made any headway with those folks to having a medically centered conversation with them?
Absolutely, we have. We have had some patients that at the very beginning were just absolutely against getting the vaccine for some of those myths that you've already discussed. And several of those patients have agreed to get the vaccine. So I feel like that's a huge win for our community and for our patients.
Dr. Temming, CBS reported last night they interviewed a nurse at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, who said, "I have never in my career been this afraid for the patients I care for." And she cares for pregnant women and women in childbirth. She says in less than 4 weeks, her hospital lost 5 pregnant women, all of them unvaccinated, and that new data shows an increase of risk of severe complications and death for pregnant women. And only about 30% of the women she's dealt with in Mississippi in her hospital there are vaccinated. So we have these 3 vaccines that are highly effective and are not dangerous, and there are no incidences reported anywhere in the world of major complications or infertility or anything else like that, and yet people won't get them. And that is leading around the country in clinical settings, Dr. Temming, to what is called compassion fatigue. How do you fight through that as somebody who has to be compassionate?
Well, it's definitely hard, but I will say, I think for myself and all of my colleagues, at the end of the day, it's just about taking care of the patient who's in front of you, and none of us wants to see anyone sick. We all came into this field to try to do good. So on a day-to-day basis, I feel actually like, with the camaraderie of other healthcare workers and with the joy that I get from my job, that it's pretty easy to try to have compassion for the person right in front of you. I will say, I think that where compassion fatigue really hits the most is at home. So coming home from work and having compassion for my family and the people around me who, have been supporting all of us through all of this, that's hard. So it certainly is a huge challenge. And I think we all just try to wake up every day renewed for that challenge and try to take each patient as they come.
Although we all know medical doctors are God, they're also human beings, and it's difficult for them, I would think, it'd be difficult for you to bifurcate yourself and be a professional, but also put your personal opinions and feelings to the side. But this compassion fatigue, as I read about it, is largely due to your folks having to take care of people who have options, who could have kept them out of the hospital and through their own negligence or their own decision-making have chosen not to do the very thing that could save them from all of this, and yet you are stuck with caring for them. How do you battle through that, Jason?
But it's interesting, Mike. As you're talking, I'm thinking about this, and that's healthcare, right? I mean, we treat patients that that are not educated. Health literacy is, and even somebody that's got maybe a PhD in rocket science might not be great. So we're teachers, we're educators. We want to teach our patients and educate them on the correct modalities of things. And when it comes to compassion fatigue and that part of it, I think having effective outlets and, you know, the camaraderie amongst the healthcare workers is insanely important. I mean, the relationships and just the teamwork that I've seen over the last year and a half has been insanely important for us to be able to bind together as a healthcare community. So to support one another through this and, you know, our families and, you know, I've certainly have had some challenges throughout this last year. My wife had breast cancer last year. So I've gone through this personally on a personal level too. So for me, it's, you know, trying to understand, you know, where they are at and help them understand, you know, the importance of this for the survival of her race, really.
I want to get your reaction to a comment I read in The Atlantic. Shavi Karkowski is a medical doctor in New York City. She wrote an article for that publication in which she writes of seeing on social media sentiments that she thought she'd never see among fellow professionals. Here are some of the things she read posted by other doctors. Quote, people who choose to be unvaccinated should not be offered lung transplants. Quote, those suffering from COVID should have to wait in the emergency room until everyone else has been seen. Some believe that insurance companies should steeply increase premiums for those who get COVID. Others don't think that they should have to pay for their coverage in the hospital if they get sick and they are unvaccinated. All of that is a component of compassion fatigue. When this is all over and we can rationally look at back on this period, will we view those statements as, and others, as outliers, as statements made in a moment of passion and fatigue, or do they have some validity? Dr. Patel.
You know, we hear statements like that quite frequently, whether it's out in the community or within the healthcare systems and so forth. More than likely, it's out of frustration and out of fatigue that healthcare workers make these comments. As I mentioned earlier, we treat our patients equally, vaccinated versus unvaccinated, pregnant, not pregnant. Everyone has the right to fight and have a chance, you know? And that's kind of where we stand. Is it daunting that these patients come in unvaccinated and take up all these beds? Absolutely. I mean, we have patients out there coming in with heart attacks and strokes, things that we can fix and sometimes don't have the bed availability for these patients. I mean, we've been accepting transfers from 3 hours away, 4 hours away, because all our healthcare systems within the Charlotte area have no bed availability. Mm-hmm. Families are having to travel from far away, leaving their loved ones. We are battling this on multiple levels.
Burnout is a problem. PTSD among healthcare workers is a problem. When there was a doctor and a nurse shortage prior to the pandemic, it's being exacerbated by that as people leave the profession earlier than they might normally have done so to because they can't deal with the anxiety and the depression and the onslaught of patients. But what about them? Are we doing enough for you? Is help available for you? Because mental health care, there is still a stigma, in particularly in certain professions, about people seeking mental health care. Can doctors and nurses seek it and not damage their career? And is that help available in sufficient amounts, given what's going on? Dr. Temming, you're nodding here in understanding.
Yeah. You know, I think that it is. I think I'm really proud of the efforts that all of the major health systems in Charlotte have made in that regard in terms of making help available. I get an email every day that has a QR code at the bottom that I can click on and talk to somebody anonymously if I need to. So I think that those resources are available and I just encourage people to use them.
Dr. Laureen Temming is a maternal fetal medical specialist and medical director at Atrium Health and Labor and Delivery. Candace Bashaw is an oncology nurse at Atrium. Dr. Siddhi Patel is a hospitalist at Caremont. And Jason Cook is the director of critical care and a neuroscientist at Novant Presbyterian Medical Center. Dr. Patel, I will leave the program with a quote from you. Trust the science and those who have dedicated their lives to caring for others. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.